You're with John Cleary on ABC Local Radio and on Radio Australia.
Thanks for joining us on Sunday night. In our first hour, we're talking about a group of heterosexual clergy marching in the gay and lesbian Mardi Gras as an act of apology for the way Christians have behaved towards gays. You can pick up that topic if you didn't get a chance to get a word in the chat room in a couple of hours' time with Samini Yasmeen, who's just returned from Pakistan. There'll be lots to talk to Samini Yasmeen in the chat room about. Coming up in this hour, one of those groups most often identified in our society with care for the marginalised is the Salvation Army. They've just appointed a director for social justice in Southern Australia, Danielle Strickland. She's our guest in this hour, and she begins by with a request. It's You Too and Yahweh.
Take this soul.
The music of You Too, Yahweh. You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia. John Cleary with you. My guest now is the recently appointed Social Justice Director for the Salvation Army based in Melbourne, Danielle Strickland. Danielle, welcome.
Thank you, John. Great to be here.
Is that the correct title?
Yes, it is. Social Justice Director for the Salvation Army Southern Territory.
Now, you are a Salvation Army officer. We should explain to people that officers are like ordained ministers in the Salvation Army, and the Salvation Army has had ordination of women for over 100 years, for all its existence.
Yeah.
That confronts some of the churches with a problem, does it? If you're a social justice director and in that position, something of a confrontation?
Well, I think it presents all of the churches with a solution, actually, John.
Tell us about your job, because this is part of an international move by the Salvation Army, isn't it? There's been an international social justice director appointed as well.
That's right. And I think there's a growing hunger, I would imagine, and have recognized the growing hunger around every church to really get involved with some systemic change for social justice. So the Salvation Army has this rich tradition early on in being involved in some pretty frontline controversial social justice moves. And then has kind of camped out over the last little while in social provision. And we tend to do a really great job at compassionate mercy. But when it comes to challenging the systems and structures of injustice, we haven't really maximized our impact. And so there's a hunger to try to really up our game in that area. And that's where my job comes in.
I guess just before we get into the specifics of your job, but talking generically, it is a problem for most organisations who seem to become pretty successful. That is, they start off as being a bit edgy and a bit confrontational, and success soon breeds a certain sort of comfort with the establishment. Is that the way you see things have evolved?
I think in some measure, perhaps that could be correct. I think the other thing is that the Salvation Army has involved itself in very grassroots, mercy-based ministry. And I think as you begin to do that, the need actually becomes overwhelming in that area. And so you just get caught up and tied up and completely...
In the direct provision of charity.
In the direct provision. Yeah, there's just so much work to be done. And we've really been about the work and not too much about the talking about the work. So... I think it's just really, we've been busy. And I think, you know, it's sort of that old proverbial idea that you can keep dragging bodies out of the water, but then eventually someone goes, we ought to go upstream and see why they're falling in the water. I think that's where we're at.
This is a constant dilemma for most church traditions too. And it seems to be expressed theologically, if you like, in the tension between charity on the one hand and justice on the other. It seems to often be expressed as an either or. You're saying it's an and both.
Yeah, I'm saying, you know, we're using Micah 6:8 sort of as a triangle of faith and mercy and justice, all being part of what it means to offer a true life to the Lord. So, yeah, I don't think it's mercy and or justice. I think it's both together with a healthy spirituality as well, because I think without the hope of a better world, without Jesus and his intervention, we're all in some trouble.
Now, this is something of a problem for politicians. Even in the last election campaign, you heard the odd cry for priests to stay out of politics. This, for you, would not seem to be a healthy suggestion.
Yeah, I think it's a naive suggestion at best to think that what you believe doesn't actually come out in what you do, and the policies don't have some sort of faith measure to them. So I think the idea of there being a possible complete separation between faith, regardless of what kind, and politics is naive at best.
Well, tell us a little about the job as you see it. What's the mandate you've been given?
Yeah, the mandate's twofold, John. One is for everyday, ordinary Salvationists. So those people who are with the Salvos, whether employees or whether they're congregational members, you know, members of the Salvation Army in churches around Australia. My first job is to mobilize Salvationists and educate Salvationists about social justice. So we're wanting really, and actually we've called the department Just Salvos, which is to say that we want Salvos to be justice-focused, but really justice-focused Salvos are really just being proper Salvos.
Being who they should be.
That's right. Yeah. So it really shouldn't be, you know, a great big large step for most Salvationists, because it's actually in our DNA. It's just a matter of rediscovering the DNA and then reapplying social justice to our contemporary setting in Australia. So that's the first part of my job, is to mobilize, inform, equip Salvationists towards justice in their own lives.
And what's the second part?
The second part of my job is to help inform the larger Salvation Army, the organization, if you will, of the Salvation Army about social justice issues, and then try to help strategize how we can lend weight to those issues in governmental and political spheres.
The Salvation Army started off very much as a movement to sort of mobilize people in the cause of these things. And that tradition is maintained, with the sort of lay membership being more than sort of membership in a congregation. The Salvation Army concept of soldiership implies much more than congregational membership. Do you see a role for the old-fashioned mass movement here, that will engage in campaigns and change issues by the force of our campaigning?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the best case scenario in social justice, I think, is a two-prong approach, which is what I'm trying to be about. So one is to mobilize a grassroots movement. I mean, even when you speak to social justice issues and you speak to the issue, but if you actually aren't doing anything to address the issue on the grassroots. You have an empty sort of portfolio. So the Salvation Army, at its best, we have a great portfolio of action, and we're wanting to increase those actions towards intentional social justice issues. But we also have the ability to speak publicly and also to the government. So if we can use those things at the same time, we have a powerful platform for change.
And as you mentioned at the start of our discussion, this is resonating with where many young people are at the moment. I mean, you opened with a selection of music not usually associated with the Salvation Army, U2 and Yahweh. That speaks that in your own mind there's a resonance with what's going on out there as well.
Yeah, fantastic. I mean, Bono's been a great champion for poverty and the alleviating of poverty, particularly in regards to Africa. And some of his speeches and even his concerts, I mean, his unapologetic stance towards political advocacy is something that's resonating in the hearts, I think, of many generations. I went to a U2 concert tour in Vancouver, Canada. The GM place there was about 10 minutes from where I lived. So I walked over and grabbed a cheap ticket on the day. Actually, it was a bit of a miracle. But when I went in, I mean, you know, he led people in prayer. I mean, he read out the Psalms about God coming in his fullness and then asked the generation to declare their commitment to make poverty history. And it's just something I'd never seen before with 30,000 crazed fans, but also really committed to making poverty history. So at the height of everyone's sort of pledges, he said, okay, pull out your cell phones, you know. So everybody pulls out their cell phones and there's like, well, probably at least 15,000 cell phones, and he actually puts on the screen the Prime Minister of Canada's phone number and says, plug this into your phone. I want you to phone. So they literally had to get the guy a new phone number after that. But it was just a classic practical thing where he said, your Prime Minister promised, you know, to commit to this certain thing, and he hasn't made good on his promise. I want 15,000 of you to call him to remind him, hey, you promised to do this. And it was just fantastic. You know, the combination of, you know, a raw, transparent cry, but then a real get down to business and let's actually do something. I think this combination, I'm quite enamored with a generation being captured by trying to change the world.
I can imagine this causes some disquiet among some Salvation Army leadership circles.
Oh, I can't imagine that, John.
Let's have another piece of music while we think about that. Coldplay is another group you've chosen to play, and the track Fix You. Why is that?
When I hear this song, I hear God singing it to me. When I hear it, actually, John, I often substitute the words I'll die to fix you. And this concept of God trying to intervene and take what could be a meaningless life and actually put it back together again is something that resonates with me.
On Sunday night, our guest is Daniel Strickland and his Coldplay.
When you try your best but you don't succeed, when you get what you want but not what you need, when you feel so tired but you can't sleep, stuck in reverse. And the tears come streaming down your face when you lose something you can't replace, when you love someone but it goes to waste. Could it be sweet?
lights will guide you home and ignite your bones, and I will try to fix you.
Fix You, Coldplay, a selection of our guest, Captain Daniel Strickland of the Salvation Army, recently appointed Social Justice Director for the Salvation Army in Southern Australia, based in Melbourne. And Daniel, we should acknowledge your accent is not local, Canadian.
That's right.
This brings in focus another aspect of the Salvation Army, that the Salvation Army actually conceives itself as an international organisation, so you can be appointed anywhere around the world, notionally.
Yeah, it's exciting. Join the army, see the world. That's the slogan.
Your involvement in social justice stems from your experience in Canada, your home turf. Let's talk a little bit about yourself and where you come from. How did you first come in contact with the Salvation Army?
Yeah, actually, the first time I met the Salvation Army, well, my parents are with the Salvation Army, and so I'd be considering myself born into the expression of the Salvation Army.
Child of the regiment, as they say.
Yeah, that's right. But I wasn't too willing a child of the regiment, so I sort of left quite quickly, was never really interested in a lot of the Salvation Army church-based stuff, and really grew up thinking religion in general was quite boring and for people who didn't really want a life. And so took off sort of in a reckless adventure and ended up leaving home at 13 and living with various people and getting addicted to drugs and ending up in jail, actually. And
just hang on. Leaving home at 13 is enough of a shock, but the path towards addiction and then jail, that's something you're skating over fairly lightly. This is something about a fairly traumatic life experience. What for you was driving you at that time as a young kid? What did you feel that you were needing to get away from?
Well, I think it was more I believed a lie, and which is a common lie, that actually recklessness and rebellion led to some sort of freedom. And so I believed the lie, and I tend to be a bit wholehearted in my decisions. So whatever I decide to do, I do it wholeheartedly. I think sort of the pursuit of rebellion, I also pursued wholeheartedly on the basis of a lie, though. And so at the end of that pursuit for me, you know, what was supposed to lead to freedom actually led to my enslavement. And then God, in his great mercy, turned a light on and revealed the lie.
You're talking about an experience which is not common for people in the ordained ministry, but it gives you some sense of empathy and rapport with kids who are going through those very same experiences. I mean, what you're talking about is something that resonates with kids on the street. Are you able to bring the lessons of your life into those situations? Because in some ways that could be a very hard thing to do. I mean, for you, it means constantly confronting who you were and what you were about.
Yeah, you know, interestingly enough, John, definitely when I first got saved, because I, you know, it was quite a miracle in terms of a life turnaround, and God had done some incredible things.
Well, tell us
things.
About that.
Well, just Jesus showed up, actually, in a jail cell and wrapped his arms around me. It was as though, I describe it as though somebody turned on a light and I saw for the first time what really was. You know, it was a really dramatic encounter.
What do you mean? This is the St. Paul experience, or was that, you say Jesus showed up, was it in the body of another person, in the sense of was Jesus embodied in a person you knew, or was this just an internal spiritual experience?
Well, I'll tell you, at first I was in a holding cell. I was in a fair bit of trouble. I was in and out of you know, jail and prison stations and stuff.
This
all
is for drug busts?
Yeah, for drug busts. And I was a car thief, actually. I stole a lot of cars. And a Salvation Army lady actually came into the holding cell, which is always surprising to me. The Salvation Army's everywhere, you know. The places we can get into are surprising. And she came into the holding cell, and it was a lady, a Salvation Army officer, actually, and who had just tried to express God to me over and over again. And I wasn't very receptive or interested. And so she made a beeline for me. And I remember saying, you know, I hope you brought some cigarettes, you know, or something useful. I wasn't very receptive. And when she came in, she didn't say a word. She just wrapped her arms around me, hugged me, and said, look, I love you, and then left. And I didn't hug back or anything. I was straight as a board, completely unreceptive. Went back to my holding cell, was alone in my holding cell, and had this encounter with Jesus, where it's really difficult to explain. I don't know, even to this day, whether it was a physical, I know I felt physical reaction, but it was as though Jesus came in. I don't know if it was a vision or what, but it was definitely a spiritual encounter where I could say that there was some sight given in that exchange where Jesus came, wrapped his arms around me, very similar to what she had done, and said, I love you, which was a bit of a shocker for me because I had thought that he wouldn't be very pleased with me. And my part of the lie that was exposed was that I also believed God was a bit like a policeman and, you know, a cosmic cop where he's up keeping track of my wrongs and, you know, wasn't happy with me. And that lie was shattered as well, as God expressed to me that actually he's for me and not against me.
How old were you?
I was 17.
Were there others affected by this immediately? I mean, were you able to go and talk about this to other people?
I actually, even after that encounter, thought, you know, I really don't make a good Christian. You know, I've tried being good before. It doesn't come easy to me. So I sort of shrugged it off and said, you know, it's really good that you love me, but I don't think I can do it. And it took me a couple weeks later, a miraculous sentence where I didn't have to go to prison for a long time, or at least what they were asking for, and went to a Salvation Army drug rehab. And through that process, eventually surrendered my life and said, okay, look, I've given it a go. Clearly, I'm not very good at it, and allowed God to have a shot at it.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio Around Australia. Our guest is Danielle Strickland, recently appointed Salvation Army Social Justice Director for Southern Australia, based in Melbourne. Danielle, Sarah McLachlan is another artist you've selected for us. Why?
Well, she's Canadian, and that's exciting. No, that's not all, but she's great. You know, Sarah McLachlan had a brother who actually died of a drug overdose in the downtown east side of Vancouver, which is where I spent the last 5 years before I came here doing church planting, but living among a drug-addicted population there in the midst of sort of hopelessness and despair. And she actually writes a song specifically for her brother, but she's an artist, I think, who understands the human elements of pain and the frustration of not seeing God intervene as much as we'd like to see. And this World on Fire song, well worth taking a look at worldonfire.com, because she offers a video to it as well. Speaking of just around the world, the kind of plight of poverty and the situation people are in, and basically saying, you know, this world's on fire, but it seems like it's more than I can handle, but I'm going to do what I can to put it out.
Hearts are worn in these dark ages. You're not alone in this story's pages. Light has fallen amongst the living and the dying, and I'll try to hold it in. Yeah, I'll try to hold it in. The world's on fire, it's more than I can handle. Diving to the water, try to bring my share.
Sarah McLachlan, World on Fire. You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia. John Cleary with you, my guest, Daniel Strickland, Social Justice Director for the Salvation Army in Southern Australia. Daniel, the experience you've described for us before we heard that song could be very reminiscent of what people romanticise as the early days of the Salvation Army. Yet these days people more associate Salvation Army membership with conservative middle-class congregations in sort of reasonably affluent suburbs. And it's a world which many Salvationists have absolutely no contact with. Is this a problem for a movement such as the Salvation Army?
I don't know if it's a problem so much, John, as an opportunity. I think it could be a problem if we were content to stay that and to transform our mission. But from where I stand, I think it's actually a beautiful testimony, first of all, of redemption lift. And what I mean by that is that if you shake any Salvation Army family's family tree long enough, a drunk's going to fall out somewhere. And the reality is that the gospel, this Jesus encounter that people have experienced, has actually lifted their lives. And then the next generation has been lifted even more. So I actually think one of the largest problems in the Salvation Army is actually one of the greatest blessings to the Salvation Army, that our generations, actually the cycles of poverty and addiction have been broken, and that families actually have been lifted from poverty. Now, the question becomes, if our main mission is to those who are impoverished and those who are oppressed and marginalized, we need to do some rediscovery, as it was, of where we need to posture ourselves and where we need to be intentional about pursuing our future. And I think I'm encouraged, working with the Salvation Army all over the place, actually, that there is a real hunger. And actually, what's very interesting is a lot of the young people that you mentioned that are the keenest about incarnational living, where they're actually leaving the suburbs and moving to the inner cities and choosing not a poverty posture, but definitely a low income posture compared to what they could have in order to reach a certain group of people. A lot of those kids that are doing that and rediscovering that are actually the great grandkids of these early Salvationist characters, you know? So it's this beautiful kind of return of what the Salvation Army was about in the beginning. You'll know that in the early Salvation Army, many of the early day leading Salvationists were actually middle class suburbanites that actually chose to leave that life and join sort of this radical movement called the Salvation Army. And it's almost like it's happening again, but it's within the movement itself.
That challenge to sort of reconnect was part of the foundation genius of the Salvation Army. I think it was the historian Ken Inglis who said the reason that the Salvos succeeded in the East End of London was because they recognised that you couldn't preach to the poor, you had to actually identify with them, and that it was this one-to-one engagement through things like the militancy and the soldiership and joining a mass movement, which gave the army its inordinate impact. There's a tendency these days, though, to see sort of uniformed organisations as talking down to people rather than living with them.
Yeah, and I think there needs to be sort of a genuine relationship. It's not just about service provision, which I think in the early Salvation Army fiery days, it wouldn't be. It would be about each person, and there'd be a sense in which that relationship was about wrestling through for the person's victory. And I think it's easier to slide into a professional social work, you know, mandate where it's just easier to help the masses from afar than it is to actually get, you know, up close and personal. One of the things in Australia that's happening, actually it's happening around the world in the Salvation Army, is this re-emergent of incarnational communities, which I'm quite passionate about because I'm a part of that movement and desire to live among and with people that I can help. And in the Southern Territory, we have what's called a Just Live Network, where it's social justice, if you break it down to its most basic form, is really about right relationships. And incarnation is this attempt to restore, you know, right relationship with people who need Christ and who need friends and who need help. And so these communities are sprouting up all over the territory, and we're just trying to network them together to support them and to encourage them and to try to maximize sort of our impact and to attract people to join those sorts of community. Just tomorrow night, actually, I'm off to Sydney for a similar gathering. Just for 2 days, they're gathering all their incarnational communities, Salvationists who are moving into welfare tight places and trying to live out the gospel among the people and be friends and genuine encounters, personal relationships being primary, and they're meeting those people. And I think we have a capacity in Australia to really impact specific neighborhoods with the gospel through incarnation. So that's pretty exciting.
One of the other things, of course, the Salvation Armies were noted for very successfully in its early days was the way it translated popular culture into the ministry while the churches were listening to the works of Parry and perhaps the young Elgar and other sort of high English composers of the late 19th century. The Salvation Army was getting down and dirty in the music halls. Salvation Army tended to get trapped in one form of that, that is the sort of brass band, which was the sort of popular instrument of the late 19th century. That change in culture, where the brass band has almost collapsed as a mode of entertainment, has seen the Salvation Army sort of disappear off the streets from the old days when the band marched down the street and sort of kids followed and all that. That's totally disappeared. What are the popular culture connections these days for a movement like the Salvation Army? I mean, and again, you're part of that. You're a musician yourself. I'd like to hear a little of that in a moment. But how do you grapple with that one?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because there's a sense in which even if you look at the Salvation Army as a church movement, even within its church, you know, so inside the walls of the church or inside the walls of the community and core, there's sort of this struggle of trying to create a contemporary expression to God, even in worship. So even our worship music is sort of trying, and I think this is true of most churches, where there's this sort of struggle to try to connect in a contemporary way, or in a way of a generation would resonate with, and try to be relevant, and at the same time, to use some of the gifts that God's given. Now, this brass band thing, interestingly enough, I've been really captured by it because I've been living in a neighborhood in Melbourne, Collingwood. My husband and I and my son just moved in to Collingwood to an apartment there. And one of the things I've been frustrated with, and this is the power of incarnation, is that you, as you live in the neighborhood, you get to realize injustices and things that are missing in the neighborhood for yourself, which really helps you resonate with them and champion them. But one of the things I've realized is that the music program in that neighborhood really suffers, just because there's really a lack of resources to help. And to I went to this one little fledgling. Another mother told me about this music program in a welfare high-rise sort of basement. And so I trudged over there with her and my son and her two boys. And it just was this small but very brutal music instruction area. And I thought to myself, you know, I think the Salvos could do such a great job here because we could bring a band. And yeah. As limiting as a band is in terms of a contemporary expression on the stage, it's fantastically empowering for poor kids, you know, that don't have any music instruction.
Yes, it's a way of changing focus from, say, the ideal of performance where you perform to a crowd and everybody loves you to
right.
participation where you move into this is a form of community that we make
yeah.
music together. And it's not so much about the performance.
And we need you. And, yeah, that's yeah. right. We're empowering kids. I mean, yeah. I was thinking about the concept of taking a 10-year-old kid, you know, from a welfare high-rise and giving him an $800 instrument to take home to practice. And I just thought, jeepers, we've been doing that for, you know, we've been taking some high risks here for a lot of years in the banding, and we've been paying some great prices on one level, but we've been reaping some great rewards in terms of people coming into community. So I actually, for me, the subject of worship and contemporary expression has also turned into a social justice kind of expression. And I think I'm after a day where we could recapture banding as a means to empower young people in places where they suffer from lack of music instruction. Well, and they just don't have the same opportunities as the suburban kids do.
Let's hear a little of your own expression in music. You've become something of a songwriter and musician. This is clearly a talent which runs through your family. Or is it something that just happened to you?
Well, this is interesting because both my parents actually are kids who grew up in poverty. My dad was sold actually as a baby illegally and grew up in a home as an orphan in a hard spot of the city. And my mom was a ward of the court, so she was removed from her house when she was 10 because of drinking and violence. And both of them actually encountered the Salvation Army when the Salvation Army went door to door in their neighborhood asking for kids to join the band. or to join the Sunday school, you know, to come to a kids club. And they both, in separate locations, trounced off. They had nothing else to do and didn't really have healthy homes. So they thought, great, fantastic. And they joined the Salvation Army and later met each other at a music camp. And, you know, then I grew up in a solid home with a good ethic and also music lessons for my whole life. So it's a great example of redemption lift, but also another example of music being a possible transforming power of the gospel at work among the poor.
Let's have a listen to an old Salvation Army song written by a former general of the Salvation Army, Albert Osborne, but your interpretation of it, Spirit of Eternal Love. Daniel Strickland on Sunday night, Spirit of Eternal Love. Daniel, the music of the Salvation Army and the work you're doing, you've described a little of it in Melbourne and your history in Canada. I'd like to get back to this international dimension, because that sort of music spread around the globe just as the movement did 100 years ago. You're part of the social justice network that is beginning to function locally, but also at an international direction. How does this all fit together?
Yeah, that's a great question, because we're discovering how we fit it together. I mean, on an immediate level, each territory, so the Melbourne-based territorial headquarters by the international headquarters has been given partner and mission territories. So one of the great and easy immediate ways that we begin international social justice initiatives is through those seven international partners that we have around the world.
So who are you partnered with?
So we're partnered with the Congo, Kinshasa. We're partnered with the Caribbean. We're partnered with Mexico. We're partnered with Mozambique, some of the poorest nations.
No links to places to our near north, like Papua New Guinea or the Philippines?
We have links to those places through people serving there. We don't have official international, you know, they're not our partner mission territories. The idea of the partner mission territories is actually quite an ingenious thing, where they wanted the developed world Salvation Army to be partnered or connected with developing world. And also they wanted that to be distributed evenly so that every nation would be covered properly, which I think is kind of a nice equitable idea. And so they give you those. Now, you're not limited to those, but those are the specific partners where you have, you know, a mandate to actually be at work in
those
nations.
Does this mean just send money, or does it mean active programs for people? Like a young kid can stick up their hand and say, I want to go and work somewhere there, and you find ways of doing it? Does it include
Yeah,
that?
Well, this is the thing. We're developing that on a social justice platform. So, which I think, you know, when it comes to social justice in an international capacity, it becomes about relationships again, and even larger relationships of a developed world partnering with a developing world to say, look, you know, we can make some partnerships that will actually benefit both of us. So we're fleshing out a scheme to do this more effectively. So one is we're actually going to have immersion trips, so learning encounters to those partners from each division. And we're going to try to beef up our micro credit capacities. So this is these economic loans and things like that that go to developing world to help people actually get their own way and means out of poverty. So they're empowering principles rather than just handing out money. And also, we can sponsor projects as they come about, and we're able to do that.
What about the economic justice issues? There's been a lot said over recent years about things like, oh, with the Make Poverty History campaign, economic justice, particularly relating to the way, say, for instance, the cocoa business exploits labour in some countries, the way fair trade needs to operate. Did you get into those areas as well?
Yeah, the Salvation Army has adopted a fair trade principle in both Australia East and Southern Territory, so across Australia, where we're really starting to beef up our intentional pursuit of fair trade in support of the movement. We're big fans of it. In a larger sense, fair trade, I mean, I'm reading William Wilberforce's biography, another one right now, and also Mohamed Yunus, who was the Nobel Peace Prize winner for economics last year, and who's created the largest, you know, Grameen bank in the world, the largest bank for the poor, basically.
Yeah, I just heard he's going to open a branch in the United States.
Yeah, fantastic. And there's actually some microcredit work going on in my neighborhood as well, with the Catholics are leading the way in that. And I think, you know, it is the way of the future. When we're reading about Wilberforce, and he's sort of suggesting, you know, the whole trade, all of the trade of England was established on slavery. So to abolish slavery would be to actually call that trade into some sort of an account.
Oh, and to rock
which is
the
what
economic
made it
foundations
so
of the country, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Really? Yes.
So people said to him, you know, this is ludicrous. You cannot do this because it will upset the balance of our trade and it'll, you know, yada, yada, yada. It can't be done. And Wilberforce just was like, that's not the point, is that it must be done because it's a wrong thing, you know. And I think when it comes to the exploitation of the poor for the rich, and when it comes to an excessive consumer culture that doesn't care about the costs to other people around the world, the Salvation Army needs to stand up and say enough. That's just wrong. We've got to actually start thinking, is it a hassle? Yeah. Is it going to be a hassle to find fair trade coffee? It could be, although it's becoming less and less so. But is it the right thing to do? And as an institution, I think we can set the pace for some change.
Let's have another song that reflects that. This is another of your songs called India Reborn. Why? Tell us a little bit about it.
I had a friend of mine who was a doctor in northern India and went on a trip to visit her for a couple of weeks. And India, you know, one of those fantastic, colorful countries, but also the poverty and the exploitation there is epidemic. And so we were talking together about the possibility of India being reborn, what it would look like for a nation to come into what it was born to be. And this song expresses a desire and a prayer, but also a real prophetic possibility that a nation can be reborn. So it's called India Reborn.
I dream of India reborn, a nation bowing down to a king of love extending his scepter, exchanging ashes for a crown. It looks like freedom for dancing and joy for tomorrow, hope for the nations all around. Sorrow is fleeing, the sun it is rising, it looks like revival in the land. Dream with us now. Dream, dream.
like bindings are breaking and chains coming over and smiles breaking like the door. The prisons come open, freedom proclaim, even the trees will clap their hands.
Danielle Strickland on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia and across the World Wide Web. You can also podcast this interview, if you'd like, on abc.net.au/Sunday Nights. Danielle, we're almost out of time, but let's finish with a little local social justice. What are the big issues that you've come into Australia in? You've been here a year or so now. You look around, just this week it's been announced by the Victorian government that they're going to open up further possibilities for gambling. This is a traditional area for the Salvos, interactive betting via your home television. We've seen Tim Costello of World Vision speak out against it this week. This seems to be sort of prime territory for the Salvation Army in terms of its mission-based campaigning. Are the Army active in these sorts of areas?
Yeah, they are. We're active. The anti-gambling stuff, I mean, the costs of gambling to a nation are extreme, and particularly to the poorest of those among us. And so our advocacy is increasing on gambling. We would agree with Tim Costello's decision to speak up against it, and we'll be joining him in that. Also, this excessive consumerism stuff we need to address as well, in terms of not only in terms of calling people to a different way to live, but also modeling that. So trying to equip Salvationists around to be models of a different way to live, a countercultural movement of people.
Well, this plays into the other big issue. Ross Garnaut this week, The Economist, is saying Australia really needs to sort of significantly cut back on its lifestyle. How can the Salvation Army impact on things like climate change, those big issues which are going to determine the face of the planet, really?
I mean, the sky's the limit of what we could do. I think, one, we can speak to the issues, which will help, because I think we are a voice that needs to be heard. So we need to speak to the issues, but also we need to empower people to think creatively about possible solutions and alternative living sort of stuff. So living simply, even. We started a campaign called Just Lose, which was about a justice-focused weight loss group, actually. So there were teams of 10 that would get together. And really what we determined are the things that enslave the most people around the world, particularly in industries like coffee and chocolate and sex, actually, are the things that are excessive things in our lives. They're not necessary things. They're things that we do to the excess. And as a result of that, they enslave us too.
Coffee, so chocolate, actually, and sex, you're cutting to the heart of everybody's
right.
ideal life. I mean,
well, just... but those things are all fine things, but in excess, they're all harmful things. So not only do they cause developing world, you know, the poor of the world to be exploited and oppressed and enslaved, but they also cause our own enslavement.
Are we going to look forward to a green Salvation Army?
Yes, of course. Yeah, we're going to do our best. Ideally, our primary emphasis is going to be for the poor of the earth, for empowerment and for freedom and for life. And so anything that affects them, we need to speak to.
Danielle Strickland, great to have you on the program. Let's finish with an anthem that perhaps reflects what you've just advised us on, the critical nature of world poverty. Jason Upton, that's a good one to finish on, and why?
Yeah, fantastic. Great song to finish on, because there's something, I think oftentimes when we think of poverty, it's like a dirty word. And we don't realize the words of Jesus when he speaks, "Blessed are the poor, for they'll inherit the earth." There's a great kingdom reversal when it comes to things that we would think is poverty. Many people, when they visit impoverished nations, come to this. There's something among the people there, an essential trust and faith and joy that they have that we're missing in our excess. And Jason Upton beautifully displays this reversal of the power of poverty in a kingdom perspective.
Danielle Strickland, it's been great to have you on Sunday night. We hope you come back and join us again sometime.
Yeah, Grace, love that.
But the God of the kingdoms and God of the nations, the God of creation sends this revelation to the homeless and penniless, Jesus the Son. The poor will inherit the kingdom to come. Turn when our
men who build kingdoms and men who build fame, but heaven does not know their names. And one will